half of the last poem in her book, Ourselves or Nothing. Those of you who read the interview in Rolling Stone know that she's an engaging poet. Not only did this book win the Lamont Award, but it's selling very well all over the country. And here is the closing of Ourselves or Nothing. I want to say also that there's something underlying here that pulls together. These are poems that took 2 or 3 years to write each. And so it's a kind of a culmination of something she's been thinking about and not just a discussion of the kind of thing we get in the newspaper headlines. In the mass graves, a woman's hand caged in the ribs of her child, a single stone in Spain beneath olives, in Germany the silent windy fields, in the Soviet Union where the snow is scarred with wire, in Salvador where the blood will never soak into the ground, everywhere and always go after that which is lost. There's a cyclone fence between ourselves and the slaughter behind it. We hover in a calm, protected world like netted fish, exactly like netted fish. It is either the beginning or the end of the world, and the choice is ourselves or nothing. So that's Carolyn Forshay. And she's very powerful, and I want to say that my poems are going to seem very, very quiet after this. So I'm going to open with my grandfather's journals. My grandfather was born in a little town outside of Kiev, Russia, around 1887. So to me, recording his history, and I'm giving you this in his voice, which I took down by hand when he was in his 80s, and he's now 97. This was something that's a very meaningful part of my life, and I've never shared it in public, and it's, again, just his voice when he's in his 80s and recalling what his boyhood was like. So he doesn't mention in the passages which I'll read the pogroms, the revolution, the kind of terrorism and persecution which the Jews were subjected to in Russia. Now my own poems I'll do in sections. First, poems when I was very young. Second, a set of love poems written in the 70s. And last, a few recent poems. I have a translation from the French novelist George Sand, but I don't think there will be time to read that one. Grandpa. My father, Nussum Fischer, was a grain merchant in Shpolokievska Guberny and was 22 when he married my mother, Faga Spatinsky, who was 20. Faga's parents broke up the marriage because Nussum was not a good provider. I was about 2 years old when they separated in 1889. We lived with my grandparents, Herschel and Esther Svetinsky, in a country town, Selania Pantua, outside of Shpola. They had a little general store. Herschel had 7 boys in addition to my mother, and they lived at home. The littlest was 4, and the oldest was 18. When I was 3, my mother remarried this guy named Ostrovsky on the agreement that I don't go with her. He had 4 children of his own. They took her away, and I was running after the horse and buggy, but my grandmother caught me and kept me. At 5, I went to school in Padua, but I didn't stay very long. It was a country school and pretty crowded. I learned my ABCs. Then when I was 8 years old, I decided I wanted to go see my mama. I hadn't heard from her or seen her since her marriage to Ostrovsky. I found out that she lives in Voznesensk from hearing them talk. One night, I stole out and started walking toward Chistchikovska railroad station. My oldest uncle, Abba, next to my mother, was a station master there. I thought I would get under a seat and steal my way to Voznesensk. I'd seen it done. The trainmaster looked under the seats before the train left, and he caught me. I didn't want him to take me to my uncle, the station master, so I started walking back home. That was 45 miles. I was walking through the forest when I heard a horse and wagon coming at me. He hollered, "Who is that?" I started crying, and I told him. He was going to my grandparents' town, so he brought me back and left me off about 2 miles from where my grandparents lived. I reached the hill in front of the house. My grandma was up early making bread. She heated up the oven with a lot of straw, which she took in from outside. She saw a little man outside and called one of her sons to see who it was. He was yelling, and I started crying and said, "It's me." It was winter, and I was half frozen. In Europe, they have a sleeping shelf on top of the oven, and they put me up there. My grandmother was crying. They didn't know what happened to me. They were happy to see me back. I was there for 6 more months. Herschel took care of the store, and the boys didn't do nothing. They were all big boys, but they just laid around the house, except for the oldest, who was a station master, and the second oldest, who was in the Army. One day, Max came home on furlough from the Army, and the whole family started debating if they should send me to my father in Chipola. My father had remarried, had 5 kids, and was selling wheat on the market. Max took me in a horse and buggy to my father's. When I got there, the stepmother didn't like it. Where they lived, it was a 3-room house with a little room off to the side for storage. They put me there. I was separated from the rest of the children and had to eat alone in the room where I lived. She was running the house, and that was it. My father didn't interfere. I had to take care of the little boy and didn't go to school. I didn't like the way they treated me, so I started walking back to my Zeta and Baba, my grandparents. It was winter. On the way, I met a Balagula, a 2-horse taxi, and he had pity and took me in the covered wagon. In the wagon, there was a cousin of mine, and he recognized me. He asked me what I was doing, and I told him, and he sent a message to my Zeta. I got back to Pantua the next day, and I started crying, and they took me in. I was there another year. I was 10 or 11, and there was nothing to do, just sitting and eating like the rest of them. I decided to go to Elizabethgrad, a city about 45 miles north. It was spring, and I walked, sleeping overnight in the forest. People gave me to eat. It took 2 nights. Keeping Watch in a Graveyard. This is a poem for Sherry Reniker, and this was an odd job she had when she was going to school in Kalamazoo, Michigan. For Sherry. When it's time to count the souls, you walk among them and feel for them through their hearts, at one with earth, bear them and bear the quiet, nothing to bury tonight. There's a light on in the tape room, Secret Service men securely in charge of polluted evidence. How can a canned conversation be kept from others once the lid is off, like an open coffin? When it's time to change shifts, you leave sunrise to the relief man, let all souls lie, and hurry home. Sonnet for Sherman Kelly. This was a great piano player when I was at college. My uncle crazy man swings blues of rain down keys pressed at the white corners of the black sound. God uncle clownabout slides down the banister breaking his song out of barrels of years. Crossing the quiet sand, these unexpectedly spill with the tears of an old Hebrew melody. Smiling, they seep down and spread through the sand in a weird symphony, making no sound. Two girls at night. One by one, we slip shivering into the sea. We find the boat in the dark. We drink wine and sky, chattering as we float. The boat rocks us out of its hold, drops us into the night. We swim to escape the wind. At the pier, the ladders weigh each limb. Water drips from our heels, robes stick to our thighs, shallow footprints and drops of sea space our noises as we return in deaf sand. Up through the garden to the house where our parents sleep, it seems quiet on the porch, and we know we fit into their dreams. I found a job there in a merchandise store. I would sweep the floor and fill the orders for dry goods, needles, thread, shirts, everything. It was named Shplansky Department Store. There was a salesman there who liked me and took me to his mother, where I became a boarder at $5 a month. Shplansky paid me $3 a week. When I was in Elizabethgrad, I found a relative, my grandfather's sister's son. His name was Tavia Deutschman, and he had a flour mill which ground wheat into flour. He employed about 90 people. He was a rich man. I found him after 6 months in Elizabethgrad because his son, Paul Deutschman, was going out with my employer, Shpolansky's girl. Paul was the same age as me. He was going to gymnasium college. I used to go to their house and sit in the kitchen like a poor boy. They had a lot of help. Paul used to ride to school in a carriage with two horses, a driver and a footman. Paul would invite me to the house once in a while, and I didn't want to push myself, so I stayed in the kitchen, like a poor schlepper. Later, when the revolution came, Paul left his father and mother and moved to New York. I worked in the store a couple of years. One winter was bad. The place was near a bridge, and when the ice broke, the basement was flooded with water. We had to carry the merchandise upstairs. It took everybody a couple of days to move the stock. I caught a cold and scarlet fever. Later, my father was in Elizabethgrad on business. He had gotten wealthy and visited the Tsar Nicholas's home many times, since he now sold grain to the Tsar and his soldiers. Nissen called me to his hotel when he heard I worked in the town. He asked me what I was doing and told me to be a good boy. That was as far as it went. I was growing up, and my stepfather relinquished and let me come stay with my mother in Voznesensk, near Odessa. He had a few harness stores. He used to make his own harnesses, and he thought he could use me. I took a train to Voznesensk at age 15 without telling anybody I was coming, and my mother was happy to see me. My stepfather took me to the store, and I started waiting on customers and learning the trade, so he liked the way I worked. The two boys also worked in the store. They were older than me, and his daughter was going to school. In Europe, every 6 months is a bazaar in another city. We used to go to Herson, put up a tent, and display the merchandise. There was a lot of German farmers living in Russia, and they were very wealthy, and they used to come to buy harnesses for the horses. It was winter and very cold, but we would sleep in the tent, just put on a lot of clothes. Ode to Beauty. This is a friend of mine who was a potter and a sculptor. Your eyes take fire from darkness and explain how the muse first sees delight. As you punch and model clay, this game wakes unfeeling, wakes feeling fingers quest, and you form, and you find a form you kneel to pose, prod unseeing eyes into a face still unpossessed. And the clod struggles from your breasts, golden hair electric in the night, frames the warmness rising in your face, glowing to a form not yet alive. Goodbye song. Somehow the taste of green apples growing in our old backyard changed. When we were young, we fit in trees like birds. The sun rises and falls across your belly. Eyes open and closed. Nothing feels better than to die in a silver film of sweat. I didn't know it could be this strong. Perhaps it was that swim I took, or my wild thoughts as I swam into the smiling eyes of the love who withdrew as gently as he came before me, or the fact that so much besides love is incomplete, feel like O'Keefe's crazy eyes with messages sealed forever in the crypt of her mind. Perhaps it seems strange, too, that in the sweetness of the long, long kiss in which we were wrapped messengers, that I lose control and shake until the timbers of our souls separate, so that lying beside each other, whole, visible worlds crowd the synchronized beating heart to heart, consciousness ebbing, drawing us closer as we part. This is a humorous poem, which I found and which I'm a little shy about reading. I wrote it in the middle of my marriage, and I don't know where it came from. I just found it. It's a catalog poem called Right to Orgasm. Little ripples lifting off, endless salt heaves of white-lipped ocean, singer fingers of wind entrapping sea grapes and Tampa grass, sun tonguing your flesh into cell explosion orgasms, blood-white piercing fangs, the cobra lover jet waves of death, appled fruit-fingered orgasms, perambulations of adolescent porcupines, slipper ease of goldfish, divine tenacity of black widows and queen bees, treetop orgasms of rainforest monkeys, mouthwatering orgasms of oranges and avocados, eggless orgasms of epileptics, cream pies of masturbators and manipulators, homely orgasms of lazy couples, tried-on orgasms of people who pay $2, old man in the sea orgasms, orgiastic crotches and armpits, precipitated orgasms of novelists and engineers, sleeping princess orgasms, blossom-cheeked hairless boys, blossom-cheeked ecstasy bubbling over and over in light waves, endangered orgasms of snowy egrets, unencumbered orgasms of devout nudists and holy rollers, velvet-clawed killer tigers exploding, faintly mystical orgasms of Zen meditators, entangled orgasms of a wall fern, braided bodies of school children, mock turtle orgasms, bone-screaking pelvis vaulted into electric coils, siren wailing lunges of a hippo, reamed eyes of a narcissistic lake, fire-fingered stars jazzing each other, the silent tears of the dead. My stepfather took a liking to me. Sometimes I would go to the bazaars by myself and set things up while he went to another town. I worked hard every day for 2 years. He didn't pay me much, just room and board and a couple of dollars as I needed. I told him I didn't see my future there. My mother cried. She gave me 100 rubles, and I went to Odessa. I bought a paper and found an advertisement for a cashier, but she had to have 300 security deposit for the job. I'm going to skip a little. I reported to the Army. I was 19 and started thinking about my future. At 20, I would have to report for the Army, or my father would have to pay a $300 fine. So I went back to my father in Shpola and gave him $300 to keep, which he took, even though he was rich. I reported to the Army in Slonim when I got to be 20, and they took me. I was there for about 3 months. We got paid 50 cents a month, 2 pieces of sugar, and 3 pounds of bread a day. We got regular meals and slept in a barracks. Then I skipped. I ran away. Slonim was about 25 miles from the border. I took a train to Odessa and went to a Jewish store. I paid a smuggler 25 rubles to take me at night to the German border. We took off our shoes and had to walk barefoot across a river and then up a big hill. There were 100 people that night, but the soldier on guard duty hadn't been paid off. We spent the night in a big stable and crossed the next night. In Germany, we had to stay together, hidden in another barn. Then they put us on a train for Holland. When we got to Holland, I hadn't decided where to go. In those days, Argentina was giving land to new prospects, so I stayed in a hotel with Jewish people and asked their opinion. One guy who was in America twice advised me to go to America. I waited for a cheap ship to America. The owner told me a cattle ship from Italy would be the cheapest. I waited 3 weeks for that ship. It cost me $35 to go by boat to America. It took 5 weeks. The boat ride was terrible. It was dirty and nothing to eat. All they fed you was herring and bread. I used to go out on the first floor, and they had plenty to eat. I had to buy food on the sly from the caterers, and I had to throw it away if an officer came around. Once I got caught and taken to the captain's quarters, but I wouldn't tell who sold me the food. Then for a week I would be sick and lay in my bunk and throw up. There was one guy on the ship who had been to America, and he befriended me when he found out I had money. My name was Fisher when I landed. I didn't change my name. I got through customs. Then I asked the policeman, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" He directed me to another policeman. I asked him where Jewish people go. He directed me to a farin, Jewish hostel. They gave me to eat and asked me if I knew anybody. Paul Deutschman was in New York peddling jewelry. His uncles were in the business. I had Paul's address and took a bus to his apartment. He lived in a room on the fifth floor. Paul took me in, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't like walking up five stories. I was in New York a month. I wrote my mother's brother, my uncle, Max Patinsky, who was in the junk business in St. Louis. He wrote back and told me to wait until he would send me a ticket. I got mad since I had money and found out from Paul it would only cost $14 for a train ticket. In a couple of days, I arrived at Union Station in St. Louis. I wasn't looking at the scenery. I was thinking, what am I going to do next? I took a horse-driven taxi to my uncle's at 8th Street in O'Fallon. There were a lot of apartments, all concrete and brick. Max owned the apartment. He lived upstairs and rented the downstairs to Italians. You had to go to the bathroom in the yard. Max used to rent out his three horses and wagons for $1 a day, and the people would go out and pick up junk, and he would buy what they would pick up. Some would bring him bottles, iron, brass, junk. Before Social Security, older women, even younger people, used to go out in the alleys picking up bottles and things. Max would bale the rags according to quality and sell them to factories. Max wanted me to get on a wagon and be a peddler, buy junk, but I didn't like it, so I went out looking for a job. One time I passed a place with a sign, "Boys Wanted." I went in and said, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" He didn't, but he had a German guy working for him. I told him I was a harness man from Europe. He was going to pay me $3 a week, starting at 6 in the morning and going until late at night. I said okay, even though I could make more money selling junk. My job was dyeing the harness strips from brown to black. I had to dip them in a huge vat full of black dye and hang them to drip. I was there a month. I was a good worker from 6 till I finished. It was a big establishment. They'd raised my pay to $5. But I was paying my uncle $3 a week, rent. I used to sleep in a wagon in the yard. Logs in the fire. Shadow in the city eye, heavy breath of sleeping child, love is gathered in the fire, golden center of desire. This is a story about my own little boy, Jomo. Van Gogh's Vineyard at Auvers and Cassatt's afternoon tea party stared at through the blue eyes of a mother whose child is annoyingly shrilling, "Where's my yellow baseball hat?" Only last week he was an angel discussing cracked Liberty Bell's mummies, Van Gogh's ear, the naked figures engrossed in a turtle, three blush pink humans turn into art. Now Jomo has painted his picture and labeled it in very precise three-year-old scrawl neatly at the bottom. He insists it says Jomo's picture and won't let me write over it. He's also drawn a lumpy tooth shape which covers a large page and overlaid it with intersecting lines and told me it is a picture of me. Now he is dotting the reverse side of Jomo's picture and drawing in feet and shapes. He says it is the art museum. Two poems for my grandfather. The first one refers to the fact that my grandfather has had silver hair since he was 20, and he's always working outside, so his skin is always kind of brown. So when I say silver and golden, I'm not only talking about the coin of the realm, I'm talking about what he looks like. Grandfather. My grandfather is silver and golden like Aztec coins which bring good luck at weddings. Through a wrinkling brow, he watches life increasing in me. I watch his sun-baked skin grow loose around his tiger bones. He is the warrior shining in my eyes. Your face. There are lines and lines in it. The curves are contained, grains in wood rubbed smooth, built into you miraculous inner circlings. I worked in this factory about a year. I saved my money. I was going to night school to learn English. It didn't cost nothing. There was a Jewish woman teacher named Cohen, but she spelled my name F-I-S-C-H-E-R instead of F-I-S-H-E-R. I didn't know the difference, that she had added a C, so I had to keep it that way. I was talking to some other immigrants who worked at Coke and Barber Supplies. They made razor straps and barber chairs. I asked them for a job there and told them I had experience making leather goods. They accepted me. So then I was making $8 a week instead of $5. I worked there for 10 years. My auntie used to go to the park on Carr Street in the daytime, and she met Pearl Mermelstein. They become real friendly. They start talking about where they lived and all of that. My uncle owned a single flat on Thomas Street, so they had a vacancy, and Pearl decided to rent the flat from my uncle. The Mermelsteins were living there a couple of months, and my aunt told me to go collect the rent. The rent was only $20 a month. My aunt used to tell them about me, that they have a nephew from Europe who's looking for a girl. When I got there, Pearl's daughter Anna opened the door. She was 15, barefoot, washing the floor. Long hair in a braid, skinny. I asked for the rent. I asked Anna out the first time we met. In those days, when you take out a girl, you had to have a horse and buggy. There were no streetcars. I rented a horse and buggy, and we went to O'Fallon Park. I was driving, and we got lost. So what? We got lost, and we got back. We went out 6 months, and I proposed. Grandma. I was 15 when I met Grandfather. My mother did all the cooking. I never cooked a thing. I had on a little black and white gingham dress. I had one, and my sister had one. And every night before we'd go to bed, we'd wash them in the sink and wring them out and put them in front of the stove to dry. We were envious of the other girls because they'd have pretty ribbons in their hair and silver shoes on, and we didn't have any of those things. I had a girlfriend, and she had a cousin who would take me to parties. He was much older than I was. After I met Grandfather, I felt the same way. But my folks were crazy about him. They loved him, he was a very good catch, and they talked to me, insisted that I marry him. He was good-looking, tall, dark, and he dressed beautiful. For 6 months, we'd go out once a week to Forest Park Highlands, or a park, and Grandpa would come over another time. He lived with an uncle who had a phone, but we had no telephone. After 4 months, he bought me a coat. On the streetcar, he would pay a nickel for me instead of paying 3 cents for a minor. The streetcars were open like a shuttle car, and you just hopped on. In the fourth month, he proposed. He asked my parents first, and I should say they said yes. They were thrilled to death. I said, let's wait a little bit. I wasn't ready. 2 months later, we got married. I still wasn't ready. We had no wedding. We went to the rabbi's study, Rabbi Rosentrater. There was no chuppah or anything. The rabbi blessed us, and that was it. Before, I went to City Hall with my father to get the license. I lied about my age and said I was 18. My father went along. That's how badly they wanted to get rid of me. I am running out of time, and I'll close with about one poem. But I just want to say that obviously my grandparents, from when my grandma was 15 and my grandpa was in his late 20s, they've lived together all these years. And so they're still together. They're way past their 75th anniversary. And I'm proud of them. So let's see. I've got maybe I should just close with one last poem. Do you really want to do this with me?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is one poem about me and one poem about my grandfather. I was coming back from Jefferson City. And I'm just looking at the countryside in autumn, the pupil of your eye. This is a Missouri River road winding across train tracks, farmlands where sun-dried corn stalks, the husks, pointers in the wind, remind me, that my summer eye must be plowed back in. Ozark Hills blaze vermilion, sugar maples drinking air turn it sweet. You come into me, I hold my breath, life and death spiral in this turning, unfolding hills echo my body, aglow with trees, mauve and grape, cerise and pumpkin, orange and chartreuse, dusty rose and spruce green, apple red and gold. This is the Missouri River Road. Rolls of hay, wood for winter, a cow, skin forelegs roped to oak branch, fleshless, skinless flesh warm, bleeding. Body cannot be denied. You did this to me. Part of me which cannot be satisfied until I satisfy myself shadows the autumn colors, the river in my eye, the road spins me across creeks. Good day for tractors, good day for live cows and trees. As you withdraw, preparing for winter, the day and sun are grainy nuggets to contemplate, the carving of my unstill life.